That'd be good if you set that up. So, great. Okay. There we go. So happy Sabbath to everyone. And it's kind of nice actually having a smaller group because you all kind of know me now, and speaking in front of large groups is not one of, on the top of my list of fun things to do. So this will be a little bit nicer for me. And I am speaking on the 7 days of creation. I'm continuing on with this. And I had to think about, it's been a while since I spoke last. It was last early in March. And I had to think about, you know, how many times I've spoken on this subject so far. But I think this is number four. And just to recap then, briefly, what I've already gone over is, first of all, I started off just speaking about the relevance of Genesis. That Genesis is the foundation upon which we base all our beliefs. And so it's so important that we have a good understanding of Genesis. And if we start to doubt the Genesis account, the creation account, then we can also start to doubt other things in the Bible. And it undermines God's authority. And so that is why it's so important that I'm speaking on this subject, and why I feel like there's not a need to rush through it, but really go through it well. And also, lost my train of thought there, but just that I was going to say, it's really important for all of us to come together on this point that no matter what you believe, because there is a lot of speculation that goes into Genesis and the creation account, but no matter what you believe, that we all come together to believe that God did create the heavens and the earth and all that's in it in 6 days, and we have a biblical worldview with that. And we did go over having a biblical worldview, how important that is, that shapes how we think and how we act. And so your worldview and Genesis go hand in hand with that. We also spent some time talking about the age of the world, whether or not it's billions of years old or if we live in a relatively young earth. We went over several different theories with that, and I spent pretty much a whole day just talking on the gap theory alone, because the gap theory is very much in our church culture. And so we went through the history of that and took a lot of time with that. And we talked a little bit about the nature of time, and I'm going to be doing this throughout my presentation, talking about some of the science behind the creation week. And so it makes it a little more interesting to delve into some of that. And then last time I spoke, we went through creation day number one and creation day number two. We talked about the science of light, that God didn't create the sun on day one, but he created light, and exactly what that is. We talked a little bit about quantum physics and the concept of non-locality and just the weird world, the physical world that we live in that God created, and the miracle of which we know more now today than we have at any point in time. But still, there's so many questions and things that scientists still don't understand. But the one thing that we do know is the more we learn about science is the more it vindicates the Bible and God's word as we get into it. And then we also went through day two. Day two is the most difficult day to understand with the language, because it's talking about the firmament or the heaven, the waters above it, the waters below it, what exactly that means. There's different theories out there, so we went through some of that, and we talked a little bit about space itself, the science behind space. Most of us tend to have the view that space is devoid of anything, that there's nothing there, but actually there are physical properties that can be measured in empty space, And we talked a little bit about the science behind that as well. Like I mentioned before with science, I have this quote here. It's by Chuck Missler, who's an evangelical Bible teacher. That's just a chart of the 7 days of creation. And so to back up, today I'm going to be going over day three and day four. Day three with the creation of dry land and plants. Day four, the creation of the sun, moon, and stars. Now for the quote by Chuck Missler. Science, which should have been the great testimony to the majesty and glory of God, has instead become a device for ignoring him and preying on the uninformed. And so one of the things I really want to do with this message is try to really turn that around and show that the science we have today actually points to God and points that we do have a creator, and that really there is no other possible explanation for the creation and the world we live in and us. And really, one of the things I wanted to do with my presentation at some point is go in and talk a little bit about Job. And so I want to do a little tangent at this point just to start off with, because in Job chapter 38, one way of stating it is that in that chapter, and actually the chapters following it as well, God is giving Job a science quiz. And I've read that God gives Job a total of 77 questions on science. And so it's going to take a long time to go through it all, but I just want to highlight some of the science things in Job. And it's starting off in Job 38. And so first off, in Job 38, verses 2 and 3, God announces that he's going to give a quiz. And it says, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. And what God is doing here, starting in chapter 38, is he's showing Job, in the grand scheme of things, that man is not nearly as important as he thinks he is. And you can further break down the next few chapters in Job here, with a series of questions that God gives him to show in three areas. One, God's creation. Two, God's providential care and balance in nature. And then three, his restraining forces of evil in the world. Okay, so let me go through some of the scriptures now here that deal with science. First of all, the rotation of the earth is in Job 38, 12 through 15. The springs and depths of the sea is in Job 38, 16. The nature of death is in Job 38, 17. And I'm not going to expound on all these because obviously it would take me a while to get through it all. The breadth of the earth, Job 38, 18. The travel of light, Job 38, 19. And that does go right along with what we talked about with the science behind light, with the creation of day one. Is light a particle? Is light a wave? Well, it's actually both, and it just depends on whether or not we're observing it. And scientists still don't quite understand the complexities of the miracle of light that God has created. The dividing of light in Job 38, verse 24. Why does beauty exist in Job 38, 26 through 27? Why are things beautiful even when there's no one there to see it? Why are flowers beautiful when bees are colorblind? It seems that God has created beauty on this earth for us to enjoy, and for him, I suppose. The source of rain and ice in Job 38, verse 28 through 30. And in verse 30, God mentions that the face of the deep is frozen. And one of the things I could have talked about when we talked about creation day one with the creation of water is water really is a miracle. Most things, and water is an exception, most things, when you heat them, they expand. And when you cool them, they contract. Well, God created with water an anomaly. so that as you cool water, it actually expands and turns into ice. And when you heat water, it contracts. So it's an anomaly from just about everything else. And God created, had to create it this way on purpose. Could you imagine if ice didn't float, so that when it froze, it raises its density and it floats? And if water had frozen in rivers and lakes from the bottom up, then we wouldn't have life like we do now. So God created that way specifically for the purpose of life. In Job 38, verse 31, God mentions the binding of the constellations Pleiades and Orion. And many people don't realize this, but those two constellations specifically, none of the other ones, but these two constellations are the only two that are gravitationally linked, meaning they're close enough together that gravity affects them. Yes, Rick. Okay, good point. Thank you. And what's interesting, the point that I'm trying to bring out, is that they're close enough together that they are linked, that they are bound, just like it says in Job. And of course, there's no way of the author of Job to have known that back then. We tend to, when we look up at constellations in the sky, we tend to think that they are all close together. But it's just like an illusion that they are. Two stars or the stars within a constellation can actually be very far apart and not have any effect of gravity on each other. But these are the only two that do. Sure. Yes, yep. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know exactly which one it is. And actually, those are one of the few I can pick out in the night sky. Yeah, I can't do a lot of the constellations, but there's a few that I can pick out. Great. Great. And actually, I got more today, too, talking a little bit about the constellations and what there is in the Bible, so there's some interesting stuff there. Okay, also, yeah, okay, we're up to Job 38 and 33. God talks about the universal nature of physical laws. And maybe jumped ahead one slide. But okay, so Job 38 and 39 through 41, God supplies the needs of animals. He preserves the species in Job 38, 39 through 41. God gave the animals their instincts and diversity in Job 39, 1 through 8. God has given us tame and untamable animals in Job 39, 9 through 12. God takes credit for the crazy design of the flightless ostrich in Job 39, 13 through 18. And this verse shows that God has a sense of humor, if you read it. And some people even say this is the most humorous verse in the Bible. In Job 39, 19 through 25, God talks about the horse, an animal that loves conflict and competition. And then in Job 39, 26 through 30, he emphasizes the hawk or the eagle. And then as we get into Job chapter 40 and 41, God describes two animals that apparently are now extinct, the behemoth and the leviathan. Now, some people, since actually, if you read the account, it's very specific what these animals look like. In detail, their diet, their habitat, their strength, their fierceness. There's a lot of detail on it. A lot of people theorize, though, that they're not real animals, that they're metaphors for, like, evil, or especially with the Leviathan, that's a metaphor for Satan. But then others believe that these are actual animals that are extinct, especially because of how in detail they're described. Some people think that the behemoth is either a hippopotamus or an elephant or a rhinoceros, But if you look at the text, it's interesting because as it describes it in detail, it describes their characteristics that could not be any of those animals. So there's actually another theory out there that what's actually talking about is a dinosaur, which is interesting. And you may ask, well, why don't they just call it a dinosaur? Right? They call it a behemoth. And that's because the word dinosaur didn't come about until the 1800s. So that's a relatively new term. The Leviathan is described as some type of sea dragon. Some people say that the Leviathan is none other than a crocodile or a whale. But again, if you read the description in Job, it describes it in a way that just does not sound like a crocodile or a whale. Apparently, the Leviathan was fire-breathing. You can read that in Job 41, 19 through 21. And so some people say that this Leviathan also could be some type of dinosaur. And also, dragon lore is common in the Middle East, in Greek and Roman culture, in Chinese and Japanese culture, all throughout the world. The Leviathan is also referenced in Psalm 104, 25. And so it is interesting. Actually, you could, you know, talk a lot about the whole theories behind the behemoth and the Leviathan. There's a lot of even science out there. I do have one slide here. Just in the last decade or so, they've found lots, actually numerous fossils that have dinosaur tissue on them, blood cells on them, that they still claim are hundreds of millions of years old, but it's just not possible to have that. So again, there's many parallels here between the first chapter in Genesis and the last four chapters in Job. God is the author of science, and as we learn more and more about science, it points the finger towards the Bible. So last time, I left off with a trivia question, and we were on day two, and so here's the passage on my PowerPoint of day two, and I'm not sure if everyone here was here last time, but basically my trivia question was, what is missing from day two in this passage here that is found in the other 6 days of creation? And the answer is that is in day two, God does not pronounce it good. The other 6 days, God says, and it was good. Okay, and so I joked that, you know, day two would correspond with Monday, okay, that God was just, you know, having a bad Monday like the rest of us, but no, that's just a joke. But it's true. Nowhere in the passage does God say that day two, Monday, is good. But when we go to day three, which we're going to today, God calls it good twice. And so in the Jewish culture, they actually have given Tuesday the name of the day of double blessing. And to give you an example, in John chapter 2, verse 1, and the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. So here you see on the third day, this is Tuesday, and there's a marriage. Well, it's very traditional in Jewish culture to get married on Tuesday. And that is why, because it's a day of double blessing. So I just thought that was an interesting little tidbit. So let's go ahead. We'll turn to Genesis 1, verse 9 through 13, and we're going to read creation day 3, the account. Genesis 1, 9 through 13. Then God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And again, we went into this passage a little bit last time because we were talking about the waters under the firmament in day two. And what are those waters? Well, right here in the text, it tells us here that the waters under the heavens were gathered into one place, and dry land appeared. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. So this is the first time in day three that God declared it to be good. Verse 11, then God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth, and it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. And so that's the second time God declared it to be good. Verse 13, so the evening and the morning were the third day. And if you were here last time, I talked a little bit about this awkward phrasing where it says the evening and the morning, and talked a little bit about the Hebrew words that it can give it more meaning if you look at the Hebrew words, that it may also be referring to God making order out of chaos. Okay, so day three is exciting because we're coming to the first point in the creation week where God is creating life. He's creating plant life, the miracle of life, which one of the things I really wanted to bring out in my talk is the complexity, I guess not just of life, but of everything, but especially with life. And one of the concepts that I really wanted to bring out with that is the concept of irreducible complexity. And I'm sure maybe all of you or many of you already know a little bit about irreducible complexity. But to start with, first of all, what is irreducible complexity? It is a single system which is composed of several interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, and where the removal of any one of these parts causes a system to effectively cease functioning. Okay. So what is that? It's a little technical definition, but what does that mean exactly? So to give you the classic example to help explain it, it would be like the mouse trap, the simple basic mouse trap, which I have up on the screen. So with a mouse trap, you have several parts. You have the catch, the hammer, the spring, the holding bar, the platform, and you need every single one of those parts to make the mouse trap work. Okay? If any single one of those parts is missing or broken, then the whole thing doesn't work. If you don't have that hammer, then you're not going to catch a mouse. Okay? If you don't have the spring, you're not going to catch a mouse. If you don't have the platform that it's on, then the whole thing falls apart. So this can be transferred or used as an analogy over to any kind of like biological system. And all these biological systems that God has created, if you just take one thing away, then the whole thing doesn't work. And this flies in the face of evolution, because evolution, according to its definition, says you have small, gradual changes over very long periods of time. Well, for something like a mouse trap to have evolved, you could never have that. You would have to have all those parts in place and created all at the exact same time for it to work. Because if it wasn't that way, it'd be completely useless. You know, if a mousetrap had evolved without the hammer, it would have never worked. It would have been a useless function. And so life is filled with examples of irreducible complexity. And to give you another classic example of life instead of the mousetrap, I'll give you the example of the flagellum, and this is the classical one that's used. Certain bacteria have a tail called a flagella, and here's a picture. And what scientists have discovered about the flagella is that it's incredibly complex. It has a tail that functions like a paddle to propel it through a liquid medium. The tail is connected to a rotor that turns in circles, and that rotor is powered by an engine. And I'll mention that the engine is fed not by the usual energy source of ATP, but instead it actually gets its energy from a flow of acid through the bacterial membrane, which in and of itself is incredibly complex. Now, scientists have discovered that these parts, the flagella, the rotor, and the engines, are incredibly complex, much more than the simple mousetrap, right? And it's made up of hundreds of precisely tailored parts. It consists of about 40 different proteins that each have different roles and functions, such as signals to turn the motor on and off, bushings to allow the flagellum to penetrate through the cell membrane, proteins to assist in the assembly of the structure. And just like the mousetrap, if any single one of these things is missing or absent, the flagella doesn't work as a whole. Okay? So how is this possible according to the theory of evolution when you have slow, gradual changes over very long periods of time? It just makes the whole theory fall apart. Now, the concept of irreducible complexity was made popular in the 1990s by a scientist named Michael Behe. and in his book, The Darwin's Black Box. So if you aren't aware of this concept or haven't read that book, I highly recommend it. And with this whole concept of irreducible complexity, as I go throughout my message, I want to continue using it, not just with biological life, but like with everything that God has created. Now, there are arguments against irreducible complexity. Okay, I looked that up. I was like, what could, you know, evolutionists possibly say about irreducible complexity? And actually, it's a little ridiculous. This is their probably their number one argument against it. And I have a slide here to show. What they'll say is if you take the mouse trap, it actually can serve as having other functions. And in the slide, it shows some of the functions. You could use the mouse trap as a nose ring or a fish hook, or you could use like as a toothpick to pick your teeth. You could use it as a tie clip, okay? A door knocker, paperweight, it has a catapult, a spitwad shooter, a catapult. So it has all these different functions. And so what they say is, well, it may not have started off as a mouse trap. It may have started off as something else, like a tie clip. And then one day it like caught a mouse, and then it became a mouse trap, okay? Now, I know it doesn't really make sense, but I'll try to give you more like a real-life example that evolutionists say. So what they'll say is that dinosaurs, not all of them went extinct. Some of them maybe went extinct, but now what the current theory is and what they actively teach as fact, really, at if you go, actually, I took my kids to the Detroit Zoo last summer, and they had a dinosaur exhibition. They teach this as fact, is that many of the dinosaurs have actually evolved into birds. And so what they say is that dinosaurs, they started growing feathers, not to fly, but just to keep warm. But then one day, one of those dinosaurs found out that it had enough feathers that it could just take off and fly. And so I actually have like a picture of this. This is a Triceratops with feathers growing from it. So I know it sounds really ridiculous, but they actually have some rebuttals, I guess, against irreducible complexity. What's interesting, though, and I got another slide, and I love this next slide because I use the classic mousetrap example, okay? But if you look at this next slide, God doesn't use the simple mousetrap, okay? This is, on the left, it's how God could do things, but on the right, it's how God chooses to do things. And so I don't know if any of you have seen that game. It's a board game. I think it's called Mousetrap. And yeah, if you have this game, or you know what I'm talking about, if you don't have this game, never buy it, okay? Never buy it for your kids. Never buy it for your grandkids, okay? Because what happens inevitably over time is that you lose one of the many pieces to the game, okay? And when you do, it just takes one. When you lose one piece of that game, it no longer works. It no longer catches the mouse, and the whole thing's just ruined then, okay? So that's the concept of irreducible complexity, as God makes it, too.
And if I could add to that mousetrap,
what you're talking
about, we're not talking about, hey, let's use this for a tie clip. That'd be cool. We're talking about, like, animals that don't have a function that makes them, because they don't have that
function, they
die.
Right, exactly.
So it's not like we just choose to use something, and, oh, look, you can catch a fish with it. It's like, no, the thing would die.
Right. Right. Exactly. And so that's kind of the point I'm trying to bring out here. Yeah, you can literally come up with thousands, maybe millions of examples, and every day scientists are learning more about the complexity of life and what God has made, and it's just absolutely unbelievable. Now, all life is composed of cells, whether it be animals, us, plants, okay, or at least one cell in the case of like bacteria. And cells, they can group together to form tissue. And we know tissue can form together to create organs, and multiple organs together create systems in your body. And it actually goes the opposite way, too. Cells have little parts called organelles, okay, inside of them, and you can further break those down into proteins, and then proteins can be broken down into amino acids, hundreds of, you know, one protein can be hundreds of amino acids. It's incredibly complex either way, from going small to large. And one of the myths of secular science today that's still perpetuated, it was taught to me like this when I was in school, and it's still taught this way, is that the whole concept of the simple cell, that the cell really is not complex. And let me show you, I got a diagram. This is just a simple diagram of a cell. And this, you would find something typical of this of any science textbook. And it is helpful, you know, when you're learning about the cell, you're memorizing the little parts in it and the shapes and what they look like. Okay, but what it does a very poor job of is showing the complexity of how cells really are. To give you a better example of how complex a cell is, I want to read to you an excerpt from the book The Hidden Face of God by Gerald Schroeder. And in this passage, the author is describing a typical cell inside a human body. And I actually have several slides of either artistic renditions or actual like pictures of cells showing a little better like the complexity of them. So I'm going to put one up there while I read this excerpt from this book here. If we could walk into a cell, our first task would be to keep from getting bowled over. We'd be faced with a myriad of micro-sized vessels moving in all directions, something like crossing Broadway against the light. But this is no hodgepodge of motion. Like Broadway, there are well-marked traffic lanes. Picture a three-dimensional intersection of several major multi-lane highways, crossovers, on and off ramps, an interlacing of clover leaves one above the other, traffic moving in all directions. Now take it down with no loss of the complex weave in to a millionth of a meter and repeat it 10,000 times in a sphere 30 millionth of a meter in diameter. You've got an inkling of a biological cell. The fiber-like roadways, the cytoskeleton, form a sort of jungle gym. They determine the flexible cell shape, hold the internal organelles in place throughout the cell volume, and provide the tracks on which newly manufactured molecules move from point of production to place of need. The item to be moved is packed into pouch-like vesicles covered with thousands of molecular motor proteins. Each motor protein reaches out a molecular hand, grabs the selected fiber, pulls itself forward by contracting, releases, extends, grabs, and pulls again. Millions of microscopic hands hauling thousands of micro-sized parcels in every cell, every second of every day. The cell is simply jam-packed, a beehive of activity. Components are stuffed tighter than the circuits of a computer board, and everything is in motion. To get a scale for the rate of activity, consider, on average, every cell in your body. At this second, and every second, is forming 2,000 proteins every second in every cell, continuously. And they do it so modestly. For all the activity, we can't feel a bit of it. A protein is a string of several hundred amino acids, and an amino acid is a molecule having 20 or so atoms. Each cell, every cell in your body, is selecting right now approximately 500,000 amino acids consisting of some 10 million atoms, organizing them into pre-selected strings, joining them together, checking to be certain each string is folded into specific shapes, and then shipping each protein off to a site, some inside the cell, some outside, sites that somehow have signaled a need for these specific proteins. Every second, every cell, your body and mine too, is a living wonder. So I just love that passage. You can look at a cell as an automatic factory. You have hundreds of thousands of robot machines, artificial languages, decoding systems, memory banks for information storage, control systems regulating automated assembly of components, prefabrication, and modular construction, error, fail-safe, and proofreading devices for quality control. But yet, the cell is way more complicated than any man-made factory. Yes. Yeah, because every cell comes from another cell. So, yes. And every cell starts off being primitive, meaning they're all alike. And then at some point, they differentiate. They become specific. And how that process goes about, scientists still don't know. And that's where even the creationists, some creationists put forth the theory that God is actually involved in every cell division in our body. And because you need some kind of orchestrator, you know, telling where all these cells to go. This cell has to become this type of cell. This cell has to be this other type of cell. We already have enough of these cells. We need more of these kind. So some believe that God is actually like a conductor or orchestrator in all of this, which is interesting to think about. The cell is capable of replicating its entire structure within a matter of a few hours. Okay. So again, if you look at your cell from the stand of irreducible complexity, evolution states that first that there was just a pool of chemicals, and then through some kind of lightning or something like that, some kind of binary fission took place and produced a cell. And not only produced a cell, but produced a cell that could replicate itself. And but if you look at what a cell really is and all the complexities, it's simply just impossible. One analogy that you could liken it to would be if you took a bunch of lumber and steel and bricks and mortar and you dropped them out of the sky. All right, before I get to that, here's some more pictures of cells I just found randomly off the internet, just showing some of the complexities of them. I don't remember off the top of my head. Some of these were artist renditions. Some of them were like colored in. This one obviously looks more like an artist rendition. I think this was maybe even looking at a specific like neuron cell. That's the bacterial cell with the flagellum there. I know that they use like electron microscopes now and whatnot, but I'm not familiar with, you know, what magnification they get to with some of these pictures. That obviously looks like it's really dialed in on something, and but also obviously it looks like they colored it in too to give it more. You can tell what things are better. This one I really liked. I almost think that this is the cell wall here. Here you have an opening with proteins that are letting things in and out, but it has to be specific. And obviously they did some coloring up here of different parts. Here's another similar picture to that one. They colored everything in, showing some of the organelles, but just incredibly complex. So back to my analogy, if you took a bunch of construction materials and dropped it out of the sky, it would be equivalent, evolution would be equivalent to it forming a factory like that. You know, like, and that's a picture of the Ford Rouge River plant. Just absolutely impossible, but that's according to the theory of evolution. One example that I found to show the complexity is with replicating DNA within a cell. Okay, replicating DNA within a cell is equivalent to having two strands of fishing line glued together that is 125 miles long, stored inside of a basketball. The two strands of fishing line are then unzipped, copied, and then restored on spools at three times the speed of an airplane propeller. The whole time inside of a basketball, and the whole time without any of them tangling. Then there's the, well, actually, I already talked about a little bit about the mitosis. Okay, let's go on here. On the third day, God created plant life. Here's a picture of the anatomy of a leaf. This picture is actually still pretty like simple, I suppose, but it's incredibly complex. Plant cells contain something called chloroplasts. And chloroplasts are responsible for photosynthesis, you know, which is basically taking the sunlight and making energy and producing sugar. Chloroplasts are sugar factories producing millions of new glucose molecules every second. Most produce more than they can use, and they store this extra sugar as starch in its roots, its stems, its leaves. And in all, plants produce about 170 million metric tons of extra carbohydrates, all from the light of the sun. It uses a two-stage process. These diagrams, they simplify everything for understanding, but it's an incredibly complex process. The first stage, it's a light-dependent reaction using sunlight. It creates ATP and NADPH that goes over here to the second process that does not use light, and through the Calvin cycle, which some of you, I'm like bringing back memories of like science class, it takes in carbon dioxide and it produces sugar here, and the byproducts go back into the first reaction, which is ADP and NADP. Again, keep in mind irreducible complexity, that two-stage process. If any one part in that process is not there, then the whole thing doesn't work. Okay, it has to all be created all at the same time for it to work. Then there's the miracle of mutual dependency with plants and animals. Plants, through the process of photosynthesis, make sugar and oxygen. Animals, humans, then eat the plants. Our byproducts of CO2 go back into the plants. That's kind of all shown here in this diagram. And again, think of irreducible complexity. You know, you have to have plants and animals all created at about the same time for all of this to work. Okay, plants cannot survive without animals, and vice versa. Okay, let's move on to creation day 4. And so we can turn to Genesis 1, verse 14 through 19 for this. Genesis 1, verse 14 through 19. Then God said, so here's another quote by God, "Let there be the lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night." And again, I just want to bring out the point that God already created light in day 1, but what he's creating here in day 4 are the stars, the moon, the sun, okay? "And let them be for signs and seasons," okay? Now, I wanted to look at the Hebrew words for signs and seasons. The word signs in Hebrew is oth, which also means a signal, as a flag, a beacon, monument, mark, or miracle. It also has the connotation of marking or a means of knowing. So the lights in the firmament are meant to mark something or to show something, to give meaning to something. And what is that? Well, certainly I believe it's what goes on. It says for signs and for seasons, so it's marking the seasons. Okay. Also, though, there is a theory out there that it does have additional meaning, referring to the signs of the zodiac. And I'm going to touch on that coming up, too. Okay. But certainly it's talking about the seasons as well. And if you look at the Hebrew word for seasons, it's translated as moed, which also means appointed time, place, or meeting. And I know Jeff and his messages have gone over that the word moed, what we get out of this is that this is a direct reference to God's holy days and his Sabbath. And so God put his holy days and his Sabbath, created them right from the beginning, right from the foundations of the earth, right here. Okay, we'll go back to reading it here. "So let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. Then God made two great lights, the great light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night." So the sun and the moon here. "He made the stars also. God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw it was good. So the evening and the morning were the fourth day." Okay, so that's day 4. I want to take a little bit to talk about corresponding topics here. I want to talk a little bit about some of secular science, how they explain the origins of our universe, our planets, and all that. So really, to start with, there's two main competing worldviews or theories out there, okay? One is the belief that our universe evolved, and evolutionist secular science will actually use that word when talking about our universe and astronomy. A lot of us think evolution is just like with life sciences and the evolution of living things, but when they say that the Big Bang happened and then our world evolved, they actually use the word evolution too. So the first view would be that our universe evolved, and it involves the Big Bang here. And then the nebular hypothesis is the hypothesis or the theory that our planets in our solar system here, including Earth, came from the sun. And so we're going to take a look at that as well. And then there's the biblical worldview that our universe was created by an intelligent designer, our creator. So I want to start off with, it's actually interesting, if you look at the history of the Big Bang, the theory behind the Big Bang actually has changed several times throughout history. It started off with the steady state model, and this is the theory that Einstein put forth about the Big Bang. And Einstein later retracted this theory because it just didn't work, the math didn't work, and he said that it was the single biggest mistake that he ever made. The steady state model came along. The hesitation model was next. Right. Okay, yeah, so the steady state model was then replaced by the hesitation model. And that was in vogue for a while, up until the 1960s. And then the hesitation model was also refuted. Okay. Next was the oscillation model, and that became popular, was in vogue. And this was eventually refuted because of entropy laws and the theory of having a lack of mass. So then the current view, the current theory is how the Big Bang works, is the inflation model or the expansion model. But there's also problems with this. And they teach the Big Bang theory as fact in schools and in society, that's how things happened. But because you need anti-gravity forces to make the Big Bang theory work, there's a problem with it, because anti-gravity forces have never been observed. So there's no proof that they exist. But yet they teach the Big Bang as theory. One little side note, whenever you study astrology or cosmology, to note is that it should be considered as a historical science, so as opposed to empirical science. So scientists are speculating about what happened in the past when it comes to astrology and cosmology. There's no way to reproduce it. There's no way to test it in a laboratory. And so it should be treated as just theories, okay? But they don't do that. They treat it as empiricism, that these are the facts and, you know, the Big Bang did happen. And so we should be aware of that. Okay. I have a little side note here. Is it possible to believe in the Big Bang and also at the same time still believe in the 6 literal days of creation? Okay, so that's my question. Is it possible to believe in the Big Bang and also the 6 days of creation? Well, there actually is a scientist out there, Gerald Schroeder, and that name might sound familiar because I read the excerpt about the cell. Well, he's got a book, too, on the Big Bang theory. And Gerald Schroeder he's a world-class nuclear physicist from MIT, and he actually works and resides in Israel. And as you can guess from his name, he's Jewish, does believe in the Bible and whatnot, and he's come up with an explanation on the Big Bang and how it fits in with the 6 days of creation. Okay, and what it revolves around is that most scientists use in the expansion model or inflation model the number 10 to the 12th power. Okay, so I got a little slide. It's a little bit technical, but I'm trying to break this down for you here to kind of explain it in a nutshell. So in secular science, the agreed-upon age of the universe is about 16 billion years, or almost 16 billion years. That's at the top here. If you want to figure out how many days that is, you times it by 365, and that's how many days you get, okay? Which turns out to be 6 times 10 to the 12th power, okay? So if you divide this by the expansion factor, which most scientists use to explain the Big Bang, you get 6 days. And here he breaks down each creation day and how much time has passed. And let me read this here. Okay, go ahead. His bottom line conclusion, okay, is this, is that a clock on the perimeter of the expansion, that is the outer edge of the universe as it's expanding with the Big Bang, okay, it would differ by 10 to the 12th power. And so a clock on the Earth would be approximately 6 billion years old at the end of creation week, but a clock placed on the perimeter of the expansion would only be 6 days old, which is what the Bible says all along. I don't know if you followed that, but he's reconciling. This is what happens when you try to blend secular science in with biblical truth. And so I don't personally believe this, but this one interesting theory out there from a very smart man. Okay. The next theory I want to examine a little bit closer is what I mentioned, the nebular hypothesis. Again, this is the popular and leading theory of the day that our sun was created by the Big Bang, and then out of the sun, our planets came out. And I don't know if you've heard in the media or whatnot, certain scientists like Neil deGrasse Tyson, certain scientists will say that all we really are is stardust. And this is where he gets that from, that the planets came out of the sun, and of course we evolved on planet Earth, according to evolution. But really, if you take us all the way back to the beginning, we're nothing but stardust. And so that's where that saying comes from. The theory states that approximately 4 billion years ago, the sun ejected a tail of materials that cooled and collected and formed our planets. And this theory, you can actually trace it all the way back to Emanuel Swedenborg in 1734. Swedenborg was a mining engineer, and what's interesting is he actually had a wide range of interests, including he claimed to have psychic powers, and he claimed that the nebular hypothesis was given to him from seances with men on Jupiter, Saturn, and other distant planets. Okay, now this fact isn't widely popularized. You're not going to find this in most textbooks. Okay, instead, credit for the nebular hypothesis is often given to Immanuel Kant in 1755. And later, Kant's theory was endorsed by Laplace. And Laplace was more well-known at the time, and so once he endorsed it, it gained respectability, despite Laplace doing the math for it. Okay, he didn't really check into the theory. And since this time, the theory has stuck, and scientists have promoted it, even though there are difficulties with the math with it. Okay. For instance, the sun contains 99.86% of all the mass in the solar system, but it only contains 1.9% of the angular momentum. The other nine planets contain 98.1% of the angular momentum. And so that's one of the major problems that scientists cannot figure out the math for and why the nebular hypothesis really is impossible. And I'm not going to go through the math on that at all. Another problem is that the outer planets are larger than the smaller ones. I'm sorry, the outer planets are larger than the inner planets, which are smaller. Yes, Rick.
So, if you follow the theory correctly,
your inner planet would actually have to be larger than the outer. Right, exactly. Especially with the point on the larger planets being on the outer edge of our solar system. Yeah, exactly. So scientists don't have a way to do the math to come up with that. It's one of the major problems with this theory. Okay, Jupiter is 5,750 times as massive as Mercury and 2,958 times as massive as Mars, and it just makes the math difficult. So exactly. There's also these coincidences with planets that scientists don't have any explanation for. There are three pairs of rapid spin rates among our planets, each within 3% of each other. Okay, Earth and Mars, Jupiter and Saturn, and Neptune and Uranus. And Earth and Mars have a virtually identical spin axis tilts of 23.5 degrees. And so again, scientists have no explanation for this, okay, But creationists, or if you have a biblical worldview, it almost appears as there was some kind of designer or creator that placed the planets there that they would all match up like that. Now, in 1966, and I think I'll probably be able to finish here. I'm going to try to speed things up a little bit. In 1966, the astronomer Carl Sagan announced that there were only two important criteria for a planet to support life. Okay, you only need two things for a planet to have life, including like on Earth. Okay, you needed to have a star that was close by in the right and the right distance, the right kind of star, and a planet with the right distance from that star. Those two things. Okay, and Carl Sagan said, given the roughly octillion, which is 1 followed by 27 zeros, planets in the universe, there should have been about a septillion, which is 1 followed by 24 zeros, planets capable of supporting life. And given these spectacular odds at life being formed on other planets, okay, there was a big push by scientists, especially in the 1960s, to look for life on other planets. And this is where you get the SETI project. Let me speed up here. The SETI project, which is stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Okay, and private and public funds were poured into these this project looking for extraterrestrial life, and actually continues to this day. Okay, our tax dollars go to finding extraterrestrial life on other planets. It was complete. I wish I had a choice on that. Complete waste of money. Okay. And this continues today, despite that it's now known that instead of two parameters that Carl Sagan put forth 50 years ago in the 1960s, instead now they have come up with over 200 parameters that are necessary for a planet to support life. And I might add that every single parameter must be perfectly met, or the whole thing falls apart. Okay. And there's the Drake equation, and what they do is they take all these parameters and they actually make an equation to figure out the probability of life being on other planets. And there's also something called the Goldilocks principle, and this states that each parameter can't be too much or too little, but has to be just right. Okay, and some of these parameters have to be as little as 10 to the negative 55th power. Okay. There's one scientist that I found, Dr. Hugh Ross, who's an astrophysicist. He took 32 out of the 200 parameters, okay, and he estimated the probability of life being found on another planet. What he came up with is it's 1 in 10 to the negative 42nd power. Okay, and in mathematics, anything that's 10 to the 50th power is considered to be completely absurd. Okay, so this is only taking 32 of those parameters, and you come up with 10 to the 42nd power. And yet our society is still looking for life on other planets and spending our money doing it. Yes. Okay, this is just a long list of some of the different the parameters needed for life on Earth. Okay, and again, there's over 200. I just listed some of them there. Okay. So last thing I want to talk about today, last little topic of interest that I already mentioned, is in Genesis 1:14. I highlighted in red there what says that, let me back up there. Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons. So when we look at the word signs in the Hebrew, that means oth, okay? And we do know that, obviously, these signs were in the sky so that we know the months, the seasons, other purposes for, like, agricultural purposes, knowing, like, when to plant our crops. The stars are also used for navigation on the seas or in the desert. There is another theory out there, though, and it's quite controversial, okay? It's quite speculative. So I'm starting off with saying that this is not like any kind of biblical truth, okay, but rather just something interesting. What the theory is that another purpose for the stars in the sky is telling the gospel message, okay? Another purpose of the stars in the sky are telling the gospel message. So again, let's go to Job 38, verse 32. Job 38, verse 32. Can you bring out Maseroth? in its season? Or can you guide the great bear with its cubs? The word Maseroth is the actual Hebrew word. Okay, it's Maseroth is only used once in the Bible. Scholars are uncertain of its derivation. But at the same time, it's very common for it to be translated, and maybe in your Bible translated as constellation, okay? Or it can be known as signs of the zodiac, okay? It's similar to the word Maseloth, which is in 2 Kings 23, verse 5, okay? Which Maseloth is often translated as constellation as well, okay? The reference is to the great bear with its cubs, and it's interpreted by some scholars as being the constellation Arcturus, or Ursa Major, and the cubs are the stars that accompany it, probably the stars that are now called the tail of the bear. If you back up to Job 38, verse 31, which we read today, talking about the binding of the cluster of Pleiades, or loosed belt of Orion, and if you actually go through the Bible, there's, I believe, all I found were, there's eight verses that deal with the stars, or specifically constellations, okay? So we do know, all the way back to at least the time of Job, that constellations are in the Bible. It does talk about constellations, okay? That's what we do know. Now, the speculative part of the theory is that God's people use the constellations to tell the story of the redemption of man, or the gospel message. The Jewish historian Josephus wrote that the constellations were named by Seth, the third son of Adam. And of course, that's just history. It's not from the Bible. In Psalms 147, verse 4, it says that God named all the stars. Okay, so the question is, maybe, did he tell us some of the names to some of the early people? Maybe did God have constellations that he told the people about? Okay. Now, this theory here was made popular by E.W. Bullinger, and you may know that name. He was he's most well known, I believe, for being the primary editor of the Companion Bible. Okay, but this was a popular theory that he promoted. Also, J.A. Seiss during the 1800s also promoted this. And actually, if you go and look on Amazon or anywhere, there's lots of books on this subject. Okay, I found a chart online that offers a brief outline of the usual zodiac interpretations, and I am running out of time, so I'm not going to go through it all, but basically what you have there are the different constellations all the way to the left, the picture that they form in the sky, and the interpretation. And these would be the biblical interpretations that they believe that they were interpreted as. And what this comes from is from, they look at different histories. They actually go look at Babylonian, Arabic, different histories throughout time and take from that. It's not coming from, none of this information over here is coming from the Bible, okay? So it's just an interesting theory to look at. Another thing to point out, when you look in the sky, and for instance, Virgo, kind of dark, hard to see, but basically here's the outline. Like, if you connect all the stars, you get like this little stick figure, okay? It really doesn't look like a picture of the Virgin Mary, you know, at all, okay? If you don't know astronomy and constellations, you may not be aware that when you look up in the sky and you look at the stars, it actually doesn't look like the actual picture, okay? But here's like an artist's rendition of what Virgo then would look like, okay? Okay, so now, is this theory true? Did God put his gospel message in the stars? What purpose would it serve, or why would he do that? So what people speculate, the reason why God may have done this is because it would be a way for people to teach their children, by using the stars, the gospel story, the gospel message, teaching God's way to their children before there was a Bible. Okay, so that's what they speculate. Again, this is all purely speculative. And again, I want to point out that nowhere in the Bible does it tell us to search the stars for the gospel message, okay? And actually, there's a strong argument not to do that, especially because the constellations and all of this have been counterfeited by Satan since Babylonian times with the whole field of astrology. And so there's a good reason why we maybe want to stay away from that now. And furthermore, we don't need to know the gospel message from the zodiac, because we have something much better. Okay, we have our Bibles that tell us the gospel message, so we don't need it. But again, I just bring it up because it is out there. I find it interesting. You may find it interesting. Okay, so then I'm going to wrap things up with one more message next time. It'll be like my last one. I'm going to talk about day 5 and day 6, and I'm going to kind of lump those together a little bit because it's talking about all the land animals, the sea animals, the birds of the air, all of them, and I'll include man with the creation of man with that. I'm going to touch on, of course, creation of the Sabbath, day 7. I probably won't talk too much about that because it's preaching to the choir, and we're really strong with keeping the Sabbath, I think. And so, but I'll touch on that. And then I think I'll probably conclude everything with talking about the ultimate proof for God's creation. There's actually a book out there by that title, and I think it would be a good way to sum everything up and present what the ultimate proof is for God's creation. So that's the end. Any other questions or anything else before I end? Sure. Right. Okay, yeah, I'll have to look that up, sure. Right, yeah, yeah, the work of creation was done in 6 days, yep. And the seventh day was still a creation, the Sabbath day, but I believe that there wasn't any like physical work done to create the Sabbath. Is just a rest. So yeah, there was a creation of another day of the week, I guess, but it was just a day of rest then, for really for us too, to keep our appointment with Him. Yes, Linda. Actually, it doesn't say in the Bible. So yeah, on the second day creation, nowhere does it say in that passage that it was good, whereas all the other days it does. And actually, in my research and stuff, there's no explanation for it. Other than we do know the next day, God does say it's good twice. So he makes up for it, I guess, on Tuesday. But why he did that, there's not explanation for it. So yeah, maybe. Yeah, yeah, for sure. And it is.
I think when it comes to like the stars and the constellations and things like that, there's more than we really understand and know all of that. Like you said, it's not necessarily in the Bible, but there's a strong oral history among the Jews. They really got into a lot of mysticism and stuff. So I think some of that is what God put in them, to have an understanding of the mystery of our solar system that we're not necessarily recorded in the Bible, but we're orally given. And I think that they personally, in some of my readings, it seems like they kind of went kind of too far with some of that and expounded on that themselves, going into mysticism when it comes to the zodiac. And, you know, but I do personally believe that he gave them an understanding of the stars and the seasons and the positioning of the stars and the heavenly bodies that is not necessarily recorded in the Bible, but that was orally given, passed down. Because I believe that God always wanted us to be very mindful of the universe, of the stars in the sky, the heavenly bodies, because he put them there as some of them there as signs for his holy days and his seasons, the year, how they were to tell the months, when the first day of the month was. And these days, you know, we don't tend to go out and see when the new moon is and celebrate that. We don't know when somebody just tells us, oh, when the Sabbath is, and somebody tells us when the new moon is. And
let me check our phone instead of looking up at the sky.
Full
Thank you. All right. Oh, Rick. Right, yeah, and that's, yep. Yeah, could possibly be, yep.
But God doesn't want to hear, even though all these people, they Israel, not to worship them.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what they said, and that's where you mentioned astrology came from.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah, and that's the danger of it. So, yep.
And I think I saw also, just looking quick, I didn't see it all, but
mm-hmm.
some of the things like the crab, and
mm-hmm.
it was selecting the regime, you know.
Right, right. Right, exactly. Yep. Right. All right. Are you able to play piano, Jonathan, or?